Fangoria presents Class of 79.
The funeral is about to begin, sir.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 79 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turned 40 this year. I'm Natasha Pacetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and this series is going to focus on my favorite movie of all time. Phantasm. In this Class of 79 series, you'll hear stories from Reggie Bannister, Paul Pepperman, Michael Baldwin, and, of course, Phantasm's creator, Don Coscarelli, who is our first guest. Don recounts how the original editor of Fangoria, Bob Martin, interviewed him for issue number 2, his early attempt to pitch Ray Bradbury on turning Something Wicked This Way Comes into a movie, and how that was one of the inspirations behind Phantasm, his reaction to seeing Angus Scrimm in costume for the first time on set, and so much more. Before we get to Don's stories, I want to tell you about Fangoria magazine. In 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. It's been 40 years and Fangoria is better than ever, each issue bringing you 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horrors past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, ever. Let me say that again. The articles in Fangoria magazine will never be online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give away any of the details inside the magazine because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you will not want to miss a single page. Head over to Fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. And while you're there, make sure you enter the promo code CLASSOF to save 15% off your subscription. That's promo code CLASSOF. Go to Fangoria.com and subscribe today. And I want to tell you about our friends at Wellgo USA. Wellgo USA is a theatrical and home entertainment distribution label that specializes in action, genre, and independent films from the U.S. and around the world. They are releasing a new limited edition Blu-ray collection of the Phantasm films that includes a scale replica of a Phantasm sphere. This is so cool. The sphere was sized at the exact measurements of Don Coscarelli's personal sphere. I cannot wait for this new set. And the new set also debuts a new 4K scan of Phantasm 2. This new transfer is also Don Coscarelli's cut of the film, including a lot of the gore that was cut by the MPAA at the time of its theatrical release. This new set arrives in October, and I know I can't wait. It's going to be really special and it's going to sell out quick. So put it on your calendar. The new set arrives in October, and thank you so much to our friends at Wellgo USA for putting this new set out. Now, join me for a figurative walk down the marble corridors of Morningside Mortuary as Don Coscarelli shares his memories of making Phantasm. Fangoria and Phantasm grew up together. Both were released in 1979, and you were actually interviewed in issue number 2 of Fangoria by Bob Martin about the making of Phantasm. Do you remember talking to Bob?
Oh, absolutely. I can specifically remember I was in New York City with Angus Scrimm on the promotional tour for the original Phantasm. I think this was in 1979. And we were in a hotel room, and this young gentleman came in, and he was very embarrassed about the name of this new magazine.
Really?
He said, it was kind of we were trying to come up with some kind of branded name for it, and we wanted to get the word fan, and we wanted to get the word gore. And so it's called Fangoria, you know, and we're all kind of talking like Fangoria. Okay. And he actually hadn't gone to print yet, but he showed me the first copy that I think it had Godzilla on the title.
Yeah.
And it looked really cool. And, you know, look, it was a wonderful to be affiliated with Fango from the beginning. Bob put me on his mailing list so I'd get a special edition of Fangoria every month that came in this wrapper that had notes from him printed on that he'd send out to his, I don't know if it went out to all of the subscribers or it just went out to the you know, the friends and family type stuff, but I still have those in a collection, most of them, I think. I love those early ones. I've even got the Motel Hell issue, which is supposed to be the rarest one. I think number 9 or something like that.
Yeah. That's a great cover. I love that cover.
Yeah. So anyway, we had a lovely interview with him, and then he's a huge supporter. And then, of course, then the era Tony Timpone, and he was, you know, a legend, and he did some great stuff. And so excited about the new incarnation of Fangoria. This is just great.
Oh, thank you so much, Don. It's so nice to hear that from you, because I really do feel like Fango and Phantasm and you come from the same place. And, you know, we just love independent movies and celebrating them. And Phantasm and Fangoria will forever be linked because of that. And that's just really cool to hear from you. And let's go back to the beginning. So you made 2 feature films before Phantasm. You made Jim the World's Greatest and Kenny and Company. And you learned a lot of lessons from those movies. And you actually pointed out one particular scene in Kenny and Company that inspired you to make a horror movie. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Kenny and Company was a film of the 70s, all right? It was, they don't make as many of these as they did back then, which were, and as with my first film, it was like a slice of life character study. You know, the first one was about a kid in high school with, problems with an alcoholic father. And then Kenny and Company was just 4 days in the life of 3 12-year-olds. And, it was very, very modest in a good way. And in any case, it also culminated on, the storyline culminated on Halloween night, which was a favorite of mine as a kid and to most kids. And I wanted to depict what an authentic Halloween night, you know, the fun, the action, the search for treasure, the scares. I want to get that all into that section. And I had this scene set in a kind of a creepy neighbor's haunted house where our 3 protagonists go in there. And so in one scene, we had one of my great crew members, Paul Pepperman, had this great Don Post mask that we had bought and a cloak. And he jumped out from behind the curtain and scared the kids in the scene. And it played great. I was really happy with it. But then I was just stunned when I showed it to an audience, because, you know, the audience just kind of bolted out of their seat when the monster jumped out in the middle of this comedy. You know, and that was a powerful response, you know, for a young filmmaker.
Yeah.
It was probably the most powerful response I'd ever had before. So, you know, it stuck with me. And then when I was thinking about making Phantasm, I thought, wow, what if I could make a movie filled with those kind of things? And that was one of the original inspirations.
And there was actually another tale that kind of inspired Phantasm, and it was Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes. Can you tell us about how Reggie brought that to you and how you actually went to try to meet Ray Bradbury?
I shall. Well, obviously, you've read my new memoir, True
I
Indie.
I love that book. Everyone needs to buy True Indie, Life and Death in Filmmaking.
Well, thank you for the plug. I appreciate it. Hey, listen, that was just a funny story, which is that, you know, Reggie Bannister was in my first film, Jim the World's Greatest. And then, of course, I loved him. You know, just like fans have grown to love him, I was madly in love with him from the moment I started working with him. On a professional level. And I worked him into Kenny Company, played this like a doppelganger of an actual teacher that I had when I was in elementary school. And Reggie was just great. We had such a great time. Then he helped on the music. Just a great collaborator. And, out of the blue, he came to me one day with a copy of this book. And he said, Don, this would make a great next movie. It stars 2 boys, and we should make it and get the kids from Kenny and Company to play the 2 boys. And the book was Ray Bradbury, Something Wicked This Way Comes. Of course, I read it. It's great. great to describe. You know, it's like a towering piece of literature and by one of the greatest American authors. And, you know, but you know, with youthful exuberance, I went with my co-producer, Paul Pepperman, and I decided, well, let's track down Ray Bradbury and talk to him about how we can make this movie. And somehow we got a hold of his address. And in his office, it was up in Los Angeles. So we drove up there from, we were based in Long Beach, about 40 miles south. Anyway, we got to this little office building, and we could, you could immediately tell where Ray's office was, because there was a doormat out front, and in big green letters, it said, "Go away."
Oh, geez.
And then on the door is a note that he's written in that said, "Please," it was begging. And I can appreciate it now, you know, having to do my own writing and having to deal with disruptions and distractions. Said, "Please don't bother me. If you have a question, call my agent. Here's the number. I'm a working writer.
Wow.
Please don't bother me." So we didn't have the nerve to knock on the door. But Paul wrote down the number and called the agent, and then agent was so excited to get Paul's call and to tell him in glowing detail about how they had just sold the rights to Something Wicked to Disney, and Disney was going to make a major motion picture out of it. So, but look, there are elements of the movie that elements of that story that had a big influence on Phantasm. You know, we didn't have two boys, but we have a single boy, and trying to get a sense of place of a kid in a small town with an evil coming into town. I think that would be, you know, one of the real influences that we got. And, you know, I've heard various stories about, you know, rumors that they were going to, you know, I wasn't too keen on the movie that Disney made. I think it lost a lot of what was wonderful in the book. And I'd heard rumors over the years that various people were going to remake it. I would love to see that movie get made, because there's so many great things in it. But one of a number of influences in Phantasm.
I would love to see you do that movie now. That would be amazing. Oh my God.
And oh, that's so, thank you.
Your own childhood nightmares influenced Phantasm. You actually had nightmares about flying orbs. Can you tell us about that and how you found Will Green and how he created the spheres for Phantasm?
Yeah, you know, hey, before that, though, truthfully, I think what inspired Phantasm most in terms of me and my dreams and sleeping was one night when I was 7 years old, I woke up and I realized that one day I was going to die, and that was an immutable fact that could not be changed. And it was probably one of the most terrifying nights of my life, lying in my little bed, looking up at the ceiling, thinking, I'm going to die. My parents are going to die.
Oh,
everyone
God.
I know is going to die. You know, and that, any rate.
That's pretty deep for a 7 year old.
Yes. Well, it stuck with me, and obviously, you know, came home to roost in Phantasm, because it really tries to get into death and all that stuff. But yeah, it is true. Only dream where I specifically have taken something from it. I had a dream about a weird little orb chasing me around corridors. You know, it never caught me in the dreams.
That's good.
But
because we know how that ends.
But, you know, yeah, no, that's true. So, hey, listen, I just thought that it might be something that would be good for Phantasm. You know, I was looking to do something unexpected with the movie. And in hindsight, looking back on the movie decades later, you know, I made a few decisions which were probably right on, which was, you know, to not make it too familiar, and at key moments to take some really weird left turns. And for some reason, I decided to take a left turn into science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think it really worked with the audiences in retrospect. And I'm glad I did it. And that was that sphere. It comes out of nowhere and obliterates that poor caretaker in a very gruesome way.
Yes.
The fans are horrified and yet enjoy at the same time.
Right.
That part of it I've never exactly understood. But anyhow, and as far as Will Green, yeah, we were floundering around trying to figure out a way to do the sphere, not having much success, you know, trying to get it to fly with piano wire and a drill or whatever. And a friend of ours knew this prop maker in Hollywood who focused more on giant turntables for autos, for auto shows. And he knew nothing about horror, and we pitched the idea. Paul and I went over there and pitched him the idea, and he really got into it. You know, it was funny. You know, it was like he was just this regular, like, straight edge effects guy. His name was Will Green, and he built this lovely sphere contraption that really worked well on screen for the drilling and for the blades extruding and all of that. You know, and he really even got into it, because I remember as we were leaving the place that day, you know, he gave us the drill and the pump, blood pump and all this stuff. And then there's a little bag of this chopped up foam rubber. You know, and I go, what's this? And he goes, oh, yeah, mix that in with the blood. It'll look like brain material coming out, you know, which I thought was interesting. It didn't actually work. We tried it. Didn't use it, but anyhow.
Wow, that's awesome that he got really into it, even though he wasn't a horror fan. That's awesome. No. You had worked with Angus Scrimm on Jim the World's Greatest. And did you have him in mind when you were writing Phantasm? Was he always the tall man?
He was there from the beginning. There's no question. You know, listen, I had had such a wonderful experience on my first two movies. You know, the first movie, Angus Scrimm starred, Reggie Bannister was in it. The second movie, Kenny and Company, featured Reggie Bannister and then Michael Baldwin. And I liked all these people, and I realized it's a lot easier to make movies with, you know, people that you know and people that you're comfortable with. Okay. And so when I was writing Phantasm, I started populating it with actors that I knew, and I could write roles for them. Of course, I created the role of Mike for Michael Baldwin, created the role of Reggie for Reggie, and thinking, you know, which of my actors I'd work with could be the evil presence. And, you know, Angus was a wonderful actor and very powerful. And he was a, you know, he could be an intimidating presence. And I sensed that. And I was the first one to really see that, which, of course, I'm just repeating some of the stories in my book, True Indy, but
read it, everyone. Is,
I remember, you know, my dear mother helped out, actually did the wardrobe on Phantasm and my previous movies, and also on Phantasm was going to do the makeup effects and the hairstyling. And I remember Angus came over to the house that we rented where we were going to shoot a lot of Phantasm to do some makeup tests, you know, and she hollowed out his cheeks with a little dark makeup. And then for the first time I'd ever seen, Angus always combed his hair over, but he combed it straight back. And she put this mirror in front of him, and I was just sitting behind him, you know, waiting, you know, for him to put on his suit and for me to check that. And he was looking in the mirror, and he was experimenting with these facial expressions, you know, where he was raising the eyebrow, and I'm going, oh, wow, that is really, you know, he was doing the tall man into this mirror. And I was like, that is really freaky. He's going to be great in this role. And so from that point on, I was secure that we had a horror villain that was going to be great.
Wow. Yeah. And he is just so, he is my favorite villain of all time. So, and what a lovely man, though, in real life.
Natasha, if you could explain that to me, because this is the thing about us, I don't understand, because in the later years before he passed, I would go to a number of the, you know, horror fan conventions, to a bunch of them back when Fangoria used to do their conventions.
Right.
Why are audiences that are terrified of the tall man in the movie theater, why do they flock to him and want to hug and kiss and pinch him in person? I never understood that. I would always watch that astonishment.
I think it's the same thing with maybe, you know, Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees, because deep down we know it's all for show, and we know it's not real, but we admire that these people can transport us to, you know, very.
That's a really a nice explanation for it.
Yeah,
that was very helpful. Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. You know, I think that's why everyone, you know, in the horror community is so passionate about horror, because we know it's not real, and there's a comfort there. It scares us on screen, but deep down we know it's not real and that this is for our enjoyment. So there's a comfort there.
Well, one of my favorite quotes by the great film director Stuart Gordon.
Yes.
Horror movies are a rehearsal for our own death.
Beautiful quote, and absolutely true.
I love that one.
So Phantasm was a huge undertaking for you and your crew. And I know, you know, shooting was done on weekends and when you could. Do you have like a memory of the most difficult part of production that sticks with you? Was there like a most difficult scene to shoot or a day that was just like, are we going to get this?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the most intellectual challenges was how we were going to get the sphere to work. We were always, you know, trying and ultimately came up with like five different answers, you know, because we split it up and, you know, we got the sphere to fly. We got it to fly around the corner. We got it to leap off, you know, to hit the guy in the head without hurting him. And we got figured out how to drill it. And that was challenging. I think from just a straight physical challenge, it was the, I think over two nights we shot a sequence which was deleted from Phantasm. It was, we used to refer to it as the hanging tree. And okay. It ended up, we used the scenes in Phantasm Oblivion, the fourth Phantasm. But that was a scene in which the brothers conspire. One of the many ways that I originally planned for them to do in the tall man was to snag him by the neck and hang him from a tree. And we had this glorious, perfect oak tree up in Thousand Oaks, California, and shot there at night. And it was, hey, it was California, but it's freaky. It was one of the absolute coldest nights in California history, I think, because all the cars had ice on them the next morning. So we were out there the whole night, and poor Angus was dangling from this tree for hours on end. And every once in a while, we'd have to let him down because, you know, he was in this harness that would cut the blood flow off to his legs, they would go numb. But he was still managed to evoke the power of the tall man up there. But that was a real challenging night for him. But the biggest challenge, of course, was we had this one little makeup trailer where all the actors would wait. It was wonderfully heated, but it was, you couldn't go in because if you went in there, and I went in there one time, it was almost impossible to force yourself to go back outside in the cold, you know? And so finally all of us decided we're not going in the trailer. We'll just suffer through it.
Just gonna suffer.
Never get back out. Yeah.
That's always difficult on shoots when the weather just isn't cooperating and it's just not, you know, nice and 70 degrees. And, but yeah, I think,
you know, let me say one other thing about movie making. Look at first, most of, you know, I hear about all the people talking about, how difficult the shoots were and all that kind of stuff. Well, most of the people complaining about it are actors working on these multi-million dollar productions. And if you ever see the tricked out trailers, each one of them with all the food and assistance and coats and everything. But the wonderful part about making indie films and not talk about too much is when you're doing night shoots, you spend the entire night outdoors, which, you know, you just don't do that often. And if you're out in a natural environment, every once in a while, it's really remarkable at 3 a.m, you know, if you're out in the woods or out in the desert and you see the, you know, the stars. And I have to tell you that I enjoy those night shootings. Although I will also say that it's shocking how all of us make these movies that take place at night, and most of us are pretty much half asleep while we're making them. I'm always surprised how good the night scenes come out sometimes, you know, for the fact that it's, you know, you're half asleep. And I hate to even say it, I have even drifted asleep during takes, and then I wake up to say cut, you know, and go, yeah, good, let's move on. And I never even, you know. So,
maybe anyway. It works. Maybe it works that way. Maybe it's just like, you know, it's good. There's no more notes to do or no more takes to do.
Well, something, you know, hey, listen, something, I've heard that there's a quote somebody once said that movies pretty much make themselves. There's something to be said about that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's every movie is a miracle for sure.
Well, that's also true.
Don, can you please tell us about the new Phantasm Sphere set, the Blu-ray edition with the scale replica Killer Spheres. I'm so excited for this.
Hey, thank you so much for asking. I really am too. You know, 2 years ago, our distributor, a company called Wellgo USA, they put out the first box set of Phantasm on Blu-ray, but they undershot on their numbers. And I think they made like 8 or 9, 10,000, I don't know, some amount of thousands. And they, and like within 2 weeks, they sold out, and,
yes.
You know, and then on eBay, I'm seeing them for $300 a pop, you know, and it was really sad. And so I said, look, you've got to, you know, reprint it. And they're going, well, I don't know if people are going to want to buy it. You know, the DVD Blu-ray market is going downhill. And then one of them had this idea, actually a producer named Cliff McMillan, a really great DVD and Blu-ray producer, suggested, oh, well, why don't you make a scale replica? And there have been some international box sets out, but make one that's exactly sized to the original sphere. So I dug through storage and I found most of the spheres from Phantasm are destroyed because they get, you know, we've always worked mostly with plastic spheres, you know, mm-hmm. so they crack and they get destroyed in the project. But I had one really, you know, pretty nice one, and I actually mailed it to them, and they got all the specs just right with the blades, and I haven't seen the finished one. They're very excited. It's going to come with a sphere, but maybe most exciting about it is a complete new restoration of Phantasm 2, which I am, you know, was able to revisit during the remastering process, and I'm really proud of that movie. You know, it's so badass. You know, and Reggie's so darn good in the movie, and some great effects by the Mark Sjostrom and Greg Nicotero mm-hmm. and Bob Kurtzman. All those guys worked on it, and anyhow. So very, very excited and proud for people to see that. And plus, not only that, but I was able to put all the X-rated scenes back in of the bloodletting, because the Motion Picture Association just destroyed Phantasm 2.
Right.
They really took it out on us. For, you know, Phantasm 1, they let the sphere scene go, and they were very unhappy with how popular the movie became. I don't know why. And then when Phantasm 2 came out, they really made us eviscerate, no pun intended, but we had to cut out all the bloodletting. So for years, people have watched Phantasm 2, and the ball comes flying, and it hits the actor in the head, and he quivers for a minute and then falls over into a giant pool of blood, and you don't even know how the blood got there. So now that's been restored, and that's great. So I'm happy about that. And there's a new 80-minute feature documentary on the making of the last Phantasm with all the cast interviews and stuff. It's good stuff. A lot of great things.
Oh, that sounds so awesome. I cannot wait to own that. I missed out on the first run.
It comes out in October.
October?
Awesome. Is the plan, yes.
Well,
providing the spheres arrive.
Lots of them. I will buy lots
great.
Of them.
So. All right. Excellent.
And I'm sure our audience will too. So, and we'll keep our audience posted on when that comes out, and be sure to
would be great.
Promote
yeah.
it, because that's amazing. I cannot
Thanks
wait
so
for that.
Much. You know, I don't know how many more, you know, collector box sets were really popular over the last 10 or 15 years, but they're slowly winding down. I heard there, I think there was one more announced, but you know, these are like, you know, it's for the Blu-ray collectors, it's the end of an era, I think.
You know, it's weird. I see a lot of people still collecting Blu-rays and actually collecting all formats of video. I know there's been a resurgence in VHS, and I know I go to a lot of VHS swap meets, and like that's a thing now, which is crazy. But yeah,
well, it was a touchstone of our lives, those VHS tapes.
Yes, I mean, it brings back nostalgia for sure. But
hey, and one other technical note, really quickly though, is that Blu-ray is a far superior viewing experience than streaming in HD.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
If you're just streaming, there's a depth of color and resolution that you get out of a Blu-ray disc, you know, in a properly tuned setup.
No, absolutely.
For the tech savvy out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a Blu-ray is definitely the way to go. And I have all of the other reissues of Phantasm on Blu-ray myself right now, and from Wellgo, and I love them. And just, yeah, we're just really excited for the new collection to come out in October. So thank you for putting that together for all the fans out there. And I have one more question for you, Don. And it's a question I ask all of our Class of 79 graduates. And it's, what advice would you give yourself 40 years ago, either in regards to Phantasm or just in life in general?
Well, in general, you know, there was a musician who was very popular in the 70s and 80s who passed away. And I remember his famous quote, once he had been diagnosed, enjoy every sandwich.
Wow.
Which I think are words, there's a guy named Warren Zevon, and I really enjoyed his work over the years. And that was a fitting little piece of philosophy, I thought. Look, as far as me, you know, obviously don't sweat the details. That's one. Everything's going to be okay. That's another. Generally, I found that generally things work out, you know, in the end. Of course, I'm not to the end yet, so I don't know how my personal story will. But no, I look back and, you know, and maybe it added to the forcing me to work harder, but I was filled with self-doubt. You know, looking at every decision on a movie, and I was always, you know, I just found myself to really try to always strive to make something better because I was afraid I was making something inferior. I don't know. And if I could go back, I would just say, yeah, you know, your work's okay. Just keep at it. But in a way, you know, it motivated me to work hard and reshoot. And maybe I took more takes than I should have. A lot of times, you know, I'd take 13 or 15 takes of a scene. Maybe I'd go back and tell myself, just shoot four and use the first one. I found so often that the first or the second take is always good. But then, you know, I grew up in the age of Kubrick where he would take 50 and 100 right. takes of scenes. You know, and I wonder if he knew, you know, I'm going to say, I wonder if he really knew what he was doing. I'd be curious to go back and look at the script notes and see which take he actually used. And my suspicion is he probably ended up using a lot of those early takes when the actors are fresher. So,
yeah.
Anyway, a couple of points.
No, that's great. That's great advice, Don. And I think everyone can take that advice to heart and use that in their own lives. And I'm so thrilled that I had the chance to talk to you today. And thank you so much for your work and for Phantasm. Phantasm personally means so much to me. And I love it. And thank you for your wonderful stories and your characters. And happy birthday to Phantasm.
Natasha, thank you. You know, I can't leave this podcast without mentioning that you were one of the movers and shakers that got the Phantasm hearse stuffing promotion that we did to memorialize going down in Texas. That will always perpetually put you in the Phantasm Hall of Fame in my book. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Don. That means so much to me.
Okay, before we go, let's just explain what that is. In 1979, AFCO Embassy, original distributor, did a crazy publicity stunt where they got some college students and they tried to see how many college kids could be jammed into the back of a hearse.
So
and
ridiculous.
I think they got about 25, and then 40 years later, Natasha almost single-handedly ran the same stunt. And how many people did you get to the back of that hearse?
30. 30 people.
Wow. A record was broken.
Woo!
So there you go.
Well, thank you, Don. Happy to do it. You know, you are the champion of independent filmmaking, and Fangoria and I and our audience will always champion you and your works and remember them forever until the tall man comes for us. So thank you so much, Don.
All right. Hey, this has been my pleasure. Thanks so much, Natasha.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 79. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love it if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 79 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pasetta, executive producers Dallas Sonier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavamare, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pasetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynerdy, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.